Welcome back to Viewpoint. We just talked with Joe Wyatt, and you heard him talk about the inaccuracies, shall we say, in the book entitled The Abomination. Well, let's find out if that is likely to have any effect. And in other words, do people really believe what they read in a book? My next guest is Victor Cheng, who is the author of a new book that is entitled Book Commercial Marketing. And it discusses the impact of books in this day and age. And I think we're going to find out a lot of things that maybe will surprise us from Victor. Hello, Mr. Cheng. How are you?
Good, Jean. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Great. Thank you. And I'm wondering what your... First of all, tell me about your book, Book Commercial Marketing.
Sure. Book Commercial Marketing, Why Books Replace Brochures in the Credibility Age, is a guide to marketers, and I suppose politicians now, you can add to that list, on how to use books to get a message across to promote a person, company, or products or services.
Okay. Now, there are thousands of books out there, of course.
Certainly.
I'm wondering, in books like this that involve politics, and in particular one candidate, and there is a question as to whether or not the contents of the book are entirely factual,
mm-hmm.
Do people believe what they read?
I think by default, barring any additional information, like comments from say, your previous guests or from other sources, barring any of the outside information, people do believe, by default, the information they tend to read in a book. Certainly in comparison to, say, something you might see on a blog or something you might see in direct mail or something forwarded from a friend via email. So by default, I think people tend to believe what they read in a book. And I think as it relates to the Abomination book, I think the Obama camp's response to the book, I think, was very critical in sort of containing the damage that was sort of initially initiated by the book.
As I understand it, the book has reached the New York Times bestseller
yes.
list, and the New York Times has done sort of a review which is highly critical of the book. And I'm wondering, you know, how has the Obama campaign responded to it, or is the New York Times review all that's out there?
Well, I think the shortly after the book came out and after it hit the New York Times bestseller list, which was, I think, the event that pushed the Abomination sort of into the national consciousness, it was more about getting up to that list because that list is so credible, that the Obama camp had put out, I think it was a 40 or 45 page rebuttal online, challenging sort of page by page specific points made in Abomination and indicating and producing facts that would, in theory, dispute some of the claims made inside the book.
People who read books, I wonder, are they going to go online and see the refuting that takes place on this, do you think?
I think some will. I think what's more likely to happen is that mainstream media will pick up that there is a rebuttal. Bloggers, which are extremely active in on the whole political side, will start noticing it and linking to it, commenting on it. They will either agree with the rebuttal or they will try to rip the rebuttal apart. But the important thing for the Obama camp is that people are talking about the rebuttal, whereas before they were just talking about the book that was very critical of Obama.
Of course, in the 2004 presidential campaign, we saw what damage the Swift Boat book did to John Kerry. This is by the same author, I believe.
Yes, it is.
And do you feel, Victor, that it's going to be equally damaging to Obama?
I don't think so. I think you know, Kerry's example was an example of what not to do when you're being attacked mm-hmm. by a book that is very critical of a candidate. You know, he sort of hoped it would go away, was very slow to respond. And I think with the Obama camp, I mean, there are a number of books out there that are critical of Obama, but this was the one that got the most traction. This is the one on the New York Times bestseller list. And once it hit that list and the mainstream media was reporting that it had hit the list, they turn around a response, I think, within 24, 48 hours of it hitting the mainstream news. So they were very fast to respond, and I think they can say thanks to Kerry for showing them what not to do in a situation like this.
Right, right. I have been told, but I'm not familiar with it, that there, a few months ago, was a similar book written by a different author about John McCain. Is that true?
Ah, geez. There are a number of books that are out there on sort of pro and against all the candidates, so that's probably entirely possible, yeah.
Okay, well, we won't go there with that one today. So what I'm hearing from you, Victor, is that what people read in books does stay with them, does influence them then.
Yeah, it does. And I think for the first couple of weeks or days or weeks where the Corsi book was out, The Abomination, I think it was starting to make an impact. I think it was starting to damage the Obama candidacy. And I think once it hit the New York Times bestseller list, it really started getting some traction. And I think that's also when the Obama camp felt compelled to respond to it and don't let this particular book go sort of unchecked. So I think they've done some damage control.
Do you think their response, do you think that has succeeded?
I would say, you know, on a scale of, you know, 0 to 100, it's probably, you know, B+, 85%.
Mm-hmm.
Even a lot of conservatives, you know, who are against Obama felt the book was factually sort of inaccurate in certain cases. And so you sort of see that being reported in the news, that you're hearing more about the inaccuracies of the book rather than the book, which was the important thing that the Obama campaign had to get out there.
Right, right. Why is it that books and, I suppose, to as much of an extent, newspapers, mm-hmm. the print media, that can have such an effect? Is it because there's so much out there on the web that people are a little dubious about, or is it because it's there in black and white in front of you? What's the secret here?
Sure, I think we'll start with books first. You know,
okay.
My theory on this is, you know, for most of us in most cultures, not just in the United States, we grew up in an education system where we had textbooks and we had exams that would test our knowledge based on what we had learned, or supposedly learned, in the books. And, you know, and I recall when I had an answer on a quiz or a test and my answer did not match the book, my grades were penalized, you know. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if I was right, if the book was wrong. It was just simply assumed that the book is the authority and the information in the book is accurate. And my personal opinion on my exam didn't really matter if it didn't match the book. And you do that, I don't know, hundreds of times over the course of, you know, typically 12 years, at least for most of us. You sort of get that habit in your head that the book must be right. You know, I've been told hundreds of times the book must be right. And even as you sort of go on and move into sort of adult life, you know, books are not factually always right. You know, and we know that intellectually. But when we're busy, that's just the default habit we have. We just have this, you know, default habit of believing that the books are right. So I think that's probably the main reason why books are so influential as a teaching tool. It's also why I think it's also very useful and influential as a marketing tool.
Would you say the same thing about newspapers?
I think so. I think with newspapers, the emphasis is a little different. I think news organizations have such high credibility, and it takes such effort to actually put something physically in print and deliver it, as opposed to, you know, putting up a post on a blog, which could take all of 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people have just a higher credibility level when someone is taking extensive steps, that's very costly financial steps, to get it to them. And there's the presupposition that they must have taken a little more care to ensure its accuracy. So I think that's why that works for things that are in print, and certainly for say, television news, for the same reason. It's so difficult to get on TV that the perception is that their accuracy is much higher than, say, like a blog or an internet posting.
Yeah, and of course, on the screen of any kind, you get much less time than
yes.
Sitting down to read a book.
Sure, definitely.
And I'm delighted to hear your explanation as to why books and newspapers carry so much weight, because I grew up in a household where we always read the newspapers, where my mother took me to the library to get library books, and where if it was in print, it had to be true.
I actually, my history teacher would make us read the New York Times, and she would quiz us on what was in the news. And whether we, you know, we didn't have to agree with it, we just had to know it existed.
Yeah.
And it was very much the same way. It was considered, you know, an authority source, that and the Wall Street Journal, the two ones we were, you know, encouraged to read.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I very much sort of grew up with the same philosophy.
I'm wondering if people care very much about the author. about his or her background, reputation. Does that make a difference?
Sure. I think this is, when you get into books as a marketing vehicle, whether for business or for politics, you know, the whole message is centered around credibility. And certainly you'll find that that over time authors develop a reputation. And I think Coriside you know, certainly has developed a reputation for taking down Kerry and being very critical of him. So you sort of understand where he's coming from politically. And so certainly it adds to, it sort of paints a picture relative to the book itself. And I think in this case, one of the reasons why it did so well on the New York Times bestseller list was because it was written by Coriside, the guy who had taken down Kerry. So the people who were already inclined to believe him were, you know, had read the previous book on Kerry, they rushed out to buy it in very large quantities in a very short period of time, which generally triggers climbing up the New York Times bestseller list.
Right. I understand, and I don't have any information on this, but I understand that there is another book written by Dick Morris entitled Fleeced, mm-hmm. That is also critical of Barack Obama.
Yeah, there's that book. There's also another book called The Case Against Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And I think, in particular, the Case Against Barack Obama, I get the perception that it's factually a lot more accurate, not as damaging from a critical standpoint, but more fact-based. And I think that's interesting is that Coriside's book has sort of, last I checked on the lists, had done the best. I think that's a large part of that is based on his reputation from his book about Kerry.
Did it surprise you, Victor, that even though it's on the New York Times bestseller list, which I guess they don't control in a sense,
right,
that then when they reviewed it, they really took out against it?
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. It sort of speaks to the credibility of the list itself, right? So this list went up. It's a book that the paper itself does not, you know, necessarily agree with or support. And you're right, the list is driven numerically based on unit sales, and they have sort of a proprietary way of how they count up unit sales. But basically, if you sell a lot of books, you appear on the list, and it's not really edited. So it's really just a function of the math.
Right.
So I thought that was quite ironic, actually.
It really is very ironic. And previously today on my program here, we were talking about something else that's sort of ironic in a sense, that there are people, particularly in one or two of the states where I'm located, that the delegates who are going to the Democratic convention, mm-hmm. although those states in the primaries voted for Hillary Clinton, that nevertheless these delegates are going to swing their support over to Obama. Mm-hmm. And that surprises me a little bit, that you can have the majority of voters in a state who are supporting one candidate, and then the delegates decide, well, we're going to vote for the other candidate. I mean, does that bother you?
Does it bother me? Oh, that's a very long conversation. I'll give you my short answer, because we could be here all day. I think in the U.S. politics, we essentially, for all practical purposes, have a two-party system. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the history of politics in other countries, they often have a lot more, you know, 10, 20, 30 parties. And so you get a lot more diversity. So I think in the United States, you end up picking either the candidate you like the least, and you vote for that candidate, or you vote for the candidate you dislike the least. So you pick the least worst candidate, and you vote for that one. And so you know, I suspect some of the voters are not going to vote somebody in; they're just trying to keep somebody else out.
Right, right. I grew up in the UK, and I wish that we followed the same system that whoever is the head of the party became in the UK the prime minister. Mm-hmm. That whoever would be the head of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party here, being the two major parties, would become the president. I think it would be so much simpler.
Yeah, and I think having more parties that were viable would just get more diversity. And so you end up finding is in the primaries, you know, each of the candidates, they've appealed to their base, right? So the people on the right go extreme to the right. People sort of on the left go towards the left. But then to win the general election, they all go to the middle.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of the rule of thumb, and it's very sort of very, very predictable. And then it's a question of sort of subtle nuances and who's sort of better at sort of winning over the middle. And that's essentially how it evolved.
There's a lot of sliding around from right to left to the middle. It's very popular.
Don't they get dizzy doing that?
You actually act as a consultant to a number of big companies, don't you?
I do.
And one of them, one of the books that you have written is How to Get Customers. And that sounds like, although it's a an economic type thing, that it could be very, very helpful to a political candidate.
Yeah, actually, that was the predecessor title to what is now known as book commercial marketing.
Uh-huh.
And it's all about using books as a marketing device to attract, I guess, new voters in this case, in the case of politics, but originally intended for the commercial sector in terms of acquiring new customers, and sort of designed for, you know, selling products and promoting products and services that are sort of complicated, require a lot of explanation, and I think unanticipatedly, the selling of a candidate is also equally complicated, requiring lots of information. And so I think I've been watching this particular election with much interest, selfishly, in the role books have played. And I think it's really been much more active than this election than in previous ones.
Are you interested, and do you want to make any predictions as to who the vice presidential candidates will be?
Oh, that's not a gamble I care to make. There's plenty of people who are more qualified to speculate on that one. I will say, though, that with respect to the books, I kind of think that Barack Obama is getting a little bit of his own medicine. You know, his book that came out, I think, well before he actually announced his candidacy, got him a lot of traction. I mean, he sold well over a million copies, developed a million fans, and I'm referring to the Audacity of Hope here, and it went largely unchecked, you know, by the Republicans until much later. And so he sort of got a free ticket for many months and a book that promoted him for and what he wanted to do with the country. And now the Republicans have wised up and have published a bunch of books sort of voting against him. And he's sort of getting a little bit of his own marketing medicine, I guess, so to speak.
Yes, I would certainly think that that's the case. And another question that I have for you here is, I've already asked you about what influenced the author or authors of any of these books would have on people's acceptance of what they're saying. And it seems to me that they take a political agenda and endeavor to tear it to pieces. Is that what you see?
Yeah, I think you either have one or two different books in sort of the political arena. You have the agenda you want to promote, which is sort of the positive spin on politics, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then you have the agenda you hate
right.
that you try to rip apart.
Yeah.
And I think at least in the past couple of weeks, you're seeing a flood of the, you know, the case, sort of the case against Obama. Whereas in the prior several months, you saw the case for Obama with his own book. So I think you're sort of seeing that clash occur right now, and it's quite fun to watch, actually.
Exactly. I'm not trying to trap you into saying something here because you don't want to predict who's going to be vice president, but I would like to know if you think that there's any possibility that Hillary Clinton will, in fact, be nominated.
I think that's a chance. I think mm-hmm. there's a chance. Although I would have sort of felt that if that was going to happen, it probably would have been done earlier. But there's always a chance, and you never know what's going on behind closed doors. But that would certainly be very interesting. That would be a historical ticket, of course.
Tell me, Victor, I believe that you have a website, and I'm sure my listeners would like to know about that.
Sure. There's two I mentioned. If you're interested in the book commercial marketing, why books replace brochures in the credibility age, Amazon.com is probably the easiest way to get it.
Okay.
And my website is bookmercial.com. That's bookmercial.com.
That's a very good word. Is that a word that you've just coined?
Yes, I invented that about a year ago.
Well, Victor, thank you so much for sharing this conversation,
Jean,
with me today. It's been great to talk with you, and I hope that you have a lot of success with book commercial marketing.
Great, I appreciate that. Thanks, Jean, very much.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.